So, the types of amino acids that we're going to be discussing are actually known as alpha amino acids. The simplest one of which would be this compound. To put an amino group right at just that alpha position and having no other carbons or other substituents, this is the molecule glycine. And as many of you might already be familiar with, there are different abbreviations that are sometimes used for these amino acids. Because if you're not familiar, the amino acids do join together to make different proteins. And specific proteins have very specific functions in the body as we try to figure out the biochemistry of whatever system, like us, then part of that effort is to do what's called sequencing of these proteins, which means figure out what is exactly that chain of amino acids. Since these are huge molecules, then to more easily represent the molecules, there's three letter abbreviations for each amino acid and a one letter abbreviation for each amino acid. I will not be so cruel as to make you memorize either of those abbreviations. I just want you to know that there are those abbreviations so you don't look silly when you go to your next class and say, what are these things? So for glycine, the three-letter abbreviation is pretty logical, GLY, or its one-letter abbreviation is G. Many of the amino acids do have the same one-letter abbreviation as the names of the amino acids themselves, but there are a couple of repeats, so there's more than one molecule that starts with A, for example. There's aspartate and there's asparagine. So they have non-A one-letter abbreviations. This simplest amino acid has no stereo center to it because the carbon has two hydrogens attached to it. All the other amino acids do have a stereo center to them because the structure of all the remaining amino acids, again, the alpha amino acids, have an R group at that position. Now let's draw a Fisher projection for this. And I'll set my visualization point like this, where I'm looking down upon... Wait a minute, hold on. Okay, strike that, reverse it. I'm looking up upon the molecule because the carbon, the dash and the wedge, I want them to be pointed towards me because I want them to be on the horizontal axis of this Fisher projection. So in order to do that, I have to look from underneath. The reason I switch to a wedge here wanted to end up with that R group on a particular side. Which unintentionally, I actually managed to swap in my head which way I did want to have it, but want to point out an issue that's going to come up when we draw amino acids. Because right now, it kind of makes logical sense to put that amino group in the plane of the board if we're just focusing on the fact it's an amino acid. But what I'm going to show you once I redraw this Fisher projection is that we can refer to amino acids with D and L designations the same way we refer to sugars. And there's a standard way that that's done, which is instead of what I did do here, which is to put the amino group in the backbone, it's instead to have the R group in the backbone and then see which side the amino group ends up on. So to do so, I'll rotate this around. And we see that that NH2 is on the right side of the molecule. And so when drawn this way, which this would be the standard way to draw the amino acids, when that group is on the right-hand side, then that is the D form of the amino acid. So let me make a more specific version of this compound. Put an actual group in for R. If we put a methyl group on, then we get alanine. So this would be D alanine. Let's go backwards from the Fischer projection to a line structure again. I have this habit of writing the carbonyl up for my carboxylic acids. I guess that's because of just the way that my O-Chem instructor had taught me. We could write this two different ways, though. If we did directly take this from the Fischer projection, then I would put the methyl group in the plane of the paper, and then would I use a wedge or a dash to write the amino group? A dash. Why? Because if I'm looking up, which I need to be if I did choose to put the carbonyl in that direction, if I'm looking up and I'm supposed to have the amino group on the right based on my perspective, I'm looking up like this, right is away from you, so that means it is going to be written with a dash. Which is why, back on that original structure, I'd written it with a dash, forgetting, though, that for the D forms like this, it's only a dash when you put the R group in the plane of the paper, instead of what I did originally, which is put the amino group in the plane. So just to show that, if I were to rotate around, again, bring that amino group from being in back of the plane and pointing down, if I bring it around to rotate up, then that's going to bring the R group, amino group coming this way, that means the R group goes this way, which is why it ends up a wedge. So if the D form is the D form because the amino group is on the right, then logically the L form is when the amino group is on the left. So this is L alanine. And again, translating from the Fischer projection back to the line structure. This time, if the R group is in the plane of the board, then we'll have the amino group as a wedge. And if we have the amino group in the plane of the board, then the R group is going to be a dash. Turns out that the L amino acids are the biologically active ones. So D sugars are biologically active. L amino acids are biologically active. Now, amino acid is a difunctional molecule, which presents some challenges if you're trying to do synthesis. Before we get into that action of joining the molecules together, let's just talk about peptides, which are a string of amino acids. or you could somewhat loosely refer to peptides as amino acid polymers. So let me make sure that I'm drawing this correctly. It's been a while. The reason that we sometimes end up going back and forth between representing the structures with the amino group in the plane of the board or not is because it's more convenient to write it in the plane of the board when we're doing exactly this, linking one amino acid to the other. Now, again, because this is a little bit out of practice for me, let me cheat and look at my notes right up above here before I put these R groups in. So notice that I've used three L amino acids. The one on the left and the one on the right, they're configured exactly the way that I've written the L amino acid previously. Notice that the amino acid in the middle, to keep that zigzag form, I've written with the carbonyl pointed down. That means it's as if I flipped the molecule 180 degrees on the paper, which is why that R group is written with a wedge instead. If you look, we have three different amino acid units here. So this is what is known as a tripeptide. And if you can remember the term amino acid, when we list the amino acids, which that list is called a sequence. The sequence is the list of amino acids from the amino end to the acid end. So to remember which way to list them, just remember the term itself, amino acid. Instead of end, sometimes the word terminal or terminus is used, just like in a bus station. So list of amino acids in a peptide from the amino terminus to the acid terminus. And again, the hint that we go from amino to acid. What kind of linkage is there between the different amino acid units? What functional group is it that we have? An amide, which is why these peptides tend to stick together in the sense that they tend to not decompose easily, because amide bonds are not all that reactive. Oops. Where'd that go. So if we're wanting to synthesize a peptide, or sometimes we're referring to the fact that there's many amino acids, we say polypeptide, we need to somehow make an amide linkage. And this is where I'm going to start edging a little bit more to the lab that we're doing. How could we put two or more amino acids together? I'm going to simultaneously describe what we're going to do in the lab a bit, but I'm also going to talk about a more general method that could be used to make even larger chains than what we're going to end up making. So first, a sort of logistical issue. which is if we had two amino acids, which, since at some point, yes, I myself included, will all be memorizing the structures of the amino acids. I've shown you two so far. Glycine, the simplest one, alanine with just a methyl group. If we have an isopropyl group, which, if I write it this way, looks like a V, then we get valine. So this is L-valine. And then leucine, which is related to valine by just putting one more carbon in between that V junction and the main platform of the amino acid. Notice that so far, all of these amino acids have had just alkyl groups and are, as what are known as the side chains, the R groups that are on the amino acid itself. We're going to see several classes of amino acids once we get to that point, which would be ones that contain OH groups, ones that contain other carboxylic acid groups, amino groups, amide groups, some aromatic groups. So there's a variety of these side chains. Yes? It doesn't have the what? No, it doesn't have R or L. I mean, it doesn't have an R group, and therefore it doesn't have an R or L designation because it's not a stereocene. So what if we wanted to put valine and leucine into the sequence V-A-L-L-E-U, which happened to be the three-letter abbreviations, which, did I put that in for alanine? No, I didn't. Alanine, A-L-A, or A. So valine is V-A-L, or V. Leucine is L-E-U, or L. So those first four are very easy to remember their abbreviations. So again, if we wanted to make this dipeptide, valine, leucine, how could we do it? What are our ways that we know to make amides? Okay. Can we easily directly reenact an amine with an amino acid to make an amide linkage? It is possible. You heat it up enough and you will dehydrate the compound. And it'd be kind of like a series of protonate open attack deprotonate, but it does require that heat to remove the water. Because what happens first is the amino group would just neutralize the acid. Remember that in our very brief what little bit of amino acids that we've covered so far, we talked about the cationic, anionic, and zwitterionic forms. So remember that the amino group can react with the acid group. So do we have another way we could make amides? You all do know there is a final for this course. So all those esters, amides, and reactions of esters and amides we did at the beginning of the quarter, which seems like another century already, but that's still this quarter. So it is reasonable for me to ask, how do we make an amide? Have you truly forgotten? Okay. A carboxylic acid is difficult to make other functional groups from because of the fact that it's an acid, which means if we take anything basic to react with it, it's just going to neutralize instead. Therefore, it would make more sense to use a more reactive group than a carboxylic acid to then react with something else to form a derivative of carboxylic acid. So what two functional groups are more reactive than a carboxylic acid? Acyl halide, which how do we make an acyl halide from a carboxylic acid? thionyl chloride. That's our answer right there. We could take the carboxylic acid, react it with thionyl chloride, turn it into an acyl halide, and end up with a mess. Why? Because if you take valine, for example, and try to react it with thionyl chloride, in principle, yes, you could get this. But since you're in a solution that also has the initial carboxylic acid in it, then you just make a dipeptide without ever having the chance to react with leucine. If you tried to put thionyl chloride into a solution of both of these compounds, then you'd even end up with a bigger mess, because both the compounds could make the acyl halides, both compounds could react with each other, so you have no control over what kind of addition would occur. Because amino acids are difunctional, you cannot directly link two amino acids together without having side reactions and getting unwanted combinations. I'll reword that slightly. Since amino acids are difunctional, it's not possible to control the order in which amino acids add to one another. Without using a protecting group strategy. Because if our problem is the fact that both molecules have an acid and an amino end to them, then what if we make it where we block the amino end of one of the amino acids, and what if we block the carboxylic acid end of the other amino acid? And that's exactly what we could do. Now, first I'm going to describe a method that could be used if all we cared about was joining just two amino acids together. And then I'm going to talk about how that's modified a bit so that you could repetitively join amino acids together. So first we have C protection, how to protect the carbon terminus, the amino terminus of an amino acid. Well, what reactions do we know that could temporarily block the reactivity of a carboxylic acid? In other words, do we know a way to convert a carboxylic acid into something that it would be easy to undo, but while it's in that form, it would not react with the same types of reagents a carboxylic acid? Well, what if we made a less reactive carboxylic acid derivative? What if, for example, we esterified? Now, if I'm going to be joining these two amino acids together, which of the two of them would I want to esterify in that manner? The right one, because leucine, the amino acid terminus, is going to be on the right-hand side. If we block that, that guarantees that valine is going to make the connection that we want to. So we're going to esterify leucine. So standard Fischer esterification. Methanol is cheap and easily available. So showing making the methyl ester. Now that N won't react with, for example, thionyl chloride or other reagents, a carboxylic acid would. Simply because we don't have that acidic proton anymore. Now what about the amino group? I always forget the proper name of this, so let me cheat and look that up. Ditert-butyl-dicarbonate. Which, if you, actually I'm not sure how they get this acronym. Must be because of another name for it. It is called the T-Boc group. And the structure of it is like this. Carbonate would be a carbonyl with oxygens on either side of it. Dicarbonate is this kind of structure. We have two of those linked together. The ditert-butyl means on either end of it, we have a tert-butyl group. Now, if you look at the structure of this, what do we have? Well, it's part ester, but it's part anhydride. So what happens when we react this with an amino acid, like valine, and we're doing this with valine because we want that amino end blocked to ensure only the carboxylic acid end will react, azunhyde. So, showing a partial mechanism, if that nitrogen attacks either of the carbonyls, this compound is symmetric, so it doesn't matter which of the carbonyls you attack, then you can push open that carbonyl. If we could all accept that, yes, we know that there's this thing called the tetrahedral immediate, but to just save space, if I could go ahead and show the next step happening at the same time, then we kick out that whole rest of the molecule. Again, it's an anhydride. Anhydrides are like acyl halides. They can react with amines to make an amide. Of course, the amine would have a hydrogen on it at first, which means once it first makes its new bond, it's going to be positively charged. So we also lose a hydrogen, and then we end up with this amide. Which you can abbreviate. And it is an amide. which means it won't react with a carboxylic acid. So we've protected the carboxylic acid end of one molecule, we've protected the amino end of another molecule. Now we can put the two compounds together. But there's another issue that can come up, which is that thionyl chloride is a pretty reactive compound. Some of these amino acids have, for example, alcohol groups in them. If we were to try to use thionyl chloride to convert just the carboxylic acid portion of that molecule into an acyl halide, there's no guarantee we wouldn't also simultaneously convert an alcohol into an alkyl chloride. Because remember, the thionyl chloride is used to make alcohols into alkyl halides as well. So there's another reagent very, very commonly used. Again, not scoring so high on the names today. Dicyclohexylcarbodiimide. Dicyclohexylcarbodiimide. Or DCC for short. Much easier, isn't it? Now, I don't think DCC was introduced in your amide chapter, was it? Some textbooks actually have it in the same chapter as amides. This one has it in your amino acid chapter. But I don't remember if it introduced it in the carboxylic acid chapter or not. The structure is this. Which, why this is called a diimide, I'm not quite sure. Because to me it looks like a double imine, in fact, two carbon-nitrogen double bonds. But we will see that this is going to result in eventually forming a type of carboxylic acid derivative. So DCC we use without any other helper reagent to link two amino acids together. Now, I'm going to anticipate a question that's going to come up at the point where we have the exam on this. Oh my goodness, if we have to write all these different structures over and over and over again as we're writing a synthesis or a mechanism, how are we ever going to finish the exam? Can we somehow simplify these structures? Yes. So allow me just pull back down the notes for a minute. Because the R groups aren't going to change by any of these reactions that we do. So we don't really need to write the R groups over and over and over again. We just care what's happening with the carboxylic acid, what kind of mechanism or transformation is going on there, and what kind of transformation might be going on with the amino group. So here's how I recommend that we abbreviate all our amino acids when we're doing these types of problems. That you use some form of abbreviation, and again, I know I just said that I don't want you to memorize the three-letter abbreviation, so you could do whatever logical abbreviation you want to, but just draw the structure kind of like a black box, and then put on the functionality that we actually care about. So I'm going to represent the C-protected leucine that I've made in this way, and then I'll represent the Bach-protected valine in this way. Oops. So, now that we have those abbreviations, let's see what the mechanism of DCC would look like. Well, DCC is not going to react with the esterified leucine, because esters have nothing that would want to react with the nitrogens here. But what about the Bach-protected valine. Is there something in that molecule that might want to react with BCC? Let me ask this. Is DCC acidic or basic? Basic, because it has the nitrogens there. Imines, like amines, are basic. Well, we have a carboxylic acid on the Bach-protected valine, don't we? So can't that carboxylic acid react with DCC just by doing a simple acid-base reaction? Yes, that's what starts this process off. Myself there. So first, just acid-base neutralization. We now have a carboxylate. We also have this positively charged nitrogen next to a carbon. Again, if this was like an imine, then this would look like protonate, which could be followed by an open and an attack, which is what happens next. I'm combining the open and attack steps because I've combined resonance with an actual mechanistic step. Then we end up with this. Which now there's an interesting series of steps that occurs. Since there's still more acid around, we can imagine that there's an acid available to have the carboxylic acid portion here protonated. And now we have the other amino acid that we protected at the C end come in. So that was the leucine. So I'm going to model what the books is showing. So recognize that technically this protonation and this attack should be separate steps. I know this looks a little bit of a mess. But if we see what had happened from the step up above, we started the protonate open attack of an amine or an amine trying to react with the ester here. The reason that this ends up being favorable is we're about to tautomerize the rest of what's remaining with the DCC. Because if you look at it, we now have a carbon-nitrogen double bond at the same place where we have an oxygen that's singly bound to that carbon. This would rather be a carbonyl because then you would have an amide on both sides. There's so much stabilization of that carbonyl, or there would be so much stabilization of that carbonyl because we would have two nitrogens, both donating their lone pairs for resonance. Well, right now, this is not nearly as stable a structure. So it's the decomposition of the DCC that is the driving force of this reaction. The slight difference in the way that the textbook is representing this compared to where I've seen it in the past is it implies that there is this cyclic reaction that occurs where the other nitrogen from the DCC can grab a proton from this carbonylamine, or the equivalent. Well, then that means that the carbon-nitrogen double bond could open up through resonance. So to simplify further, I'll just extend that arrow to show it coming from the double bond. Well, that's because, again, the carbonyl wants to form, which means this carbon-oxygen bond breaks. And since the alcohol portion here got deprotonated, that bond has to have somewhere to go. And if you look at what we end up with, the DCC, again, has now decomposed into being a urea derivative. And then what we have left over, if I turn it back around, writing it from amino end to the acid end, it's going to look like this. So we've now successfully made our dipeptide. Now how could we remove the protecting groups? Well, it does turn out that an ester is more reactive than an amide. So the methyl ester we could hydrolyze. If we hydrolyze, we're at the same time going to be able to take care of that TBOC group. Because let me expand out that structure again. And in fact, let me talk about just that end separately. To use a strong acid that wouldn't cause any other side reactions,
trifluoroacetic acid is often used for this purpose.
So if you notice that trifluoroacetic acid could react with an ester
to turn it back to a carboxylic acid. The ester portion of this is more reactive than the amide portion, which is why the amide portion is left alone. But you might recognize this as one of those types of carboxylic acids that's not thermodynamically stable. And so, spontaneously, this loses carbon dioxide. And so we've deprotected the amino end. Now, the ester end I'm not showing, but that would just be simple hydrolysis. If this ester could be hydrolyzed, the other ester could be hydrolyzed as well to give us our carboxylic acid. So reviewing the steps, and I'll move it out of the way so you can finish writing then. I was saying that we wanted to make a dipeptide sequence. And so I introduced two amino acids, valine and leucine. And I pointed out the problem that to join the two together, we have to block one end of each molecule because otherwise we can't control how they're assembled. So I showed you C protection, which a simple way to do it, but not the best way, but our first pass, is to make a methyl ester. We also have to protect the amino end of the other amino acid, and that's where this Bach protecting group comes from. The reason the Bach protecting group is used is we could protect the amino group by making an amide. That's really unreactive. But the whole point of this is to make an amide. And so it doesn't make sense to make an amide protecting group if we're trying to make an amide functional group, because how could you deprotect at the end? But Bach is a very sneaky reagent because, yes, it's an anhydride, so it's going to add to the amino group in this way. But it's also an ester, and so we can hydrolyze the ester portion, that's what we did last, without the amide portion being affected, until after removing that ester portion, you have a decarboxylation. So it's kind of a slick trick that you can pull. Once you do have your carbon-protected amino acid, your nitrogen-protected amino acid, you're controlling which amino group and carboxylic acid group react. And then I've shown you this alternate reagent, DCC, that can be used to join the reagents without using harsh conditions like thionyl chloride. Because this happens under virtually neutral conditions. The carboxylic acid itself provides a proton to start this process off. Now, I know we're running a little over here, but I have just a little bit more to show you highly related synthesis, but how we could more easily make larger amino acid chains. So before I do that, though, are there any questions up to this point? And what I'm going to show you next is not what we're doing in the lab, but if I've shown you this much, it doesn't make sense to stop without showing you this extremely related process. So what I'm going to show you now is what's known as the Merrifield resin synthesis. And first I'm going to tell you the story of this Merrifield resin and then talk about how it's used. So two slight portions to this. A little bit of reach back to Chem 12b. What's the name of this molecule? Styrene. And if you were to react this with either extremely basic reagent like a Grignard reagent, or if we react this with light, or it's even possible react with this with acid, then we can make polystyrene, exactly the same type of polystyrene that you think of when we have styrofoam cups. If I think of the appearance of the styrofoam cup, if you crush it, it's like it's formed of these little beads of material, right? So what if we were to purposely synthesize this polystyrene in such a way that we produce these beads of material?
Now, instead of just making it from plain styrene, we add a bit of functionalized styrene, chloromethyl styrene, parachloromethyl styrene. Then you make what's called a copolymer. Polymer means making a huge molecule out of multiple repetitions of a smaller molecule. Copolymer means to do it with two of them. So you don't make it completely this substituted styrene, because what we want is a bead that every few places, every little once in a while, around that structure, around that bead, we have these functionalized styrenes. And I'm highly simplifying the way I'm drawing the structures, which, yes, that means you could do the same thing. Because at this point, I'm not trying to make you show you could draw a structure. I want you to know what happens to this resin. And in fact, to again simplify, here's the way I'm going to write it. The resin, the bead, with this chlorine on a methyl group sticking off. But if I simplify in this way, we've got to keep in mind it's a chlorine on a methyl group on benzene. And what do we call these kinds of structures where we have substitution at one carbon away from benzene? Not allyl, that's if you have a substituent on a carbon next to a double bond. If we have a substituent on a carbon next to a benzene ring, then that's called benzyl. But it's very reactive. Benzyl chlorides in general are good substrates for SN2 reactions. So, can with my last brain cell, I remember the structures of glycine and alanine and valine without looking? Let's see, glycine was this one, L-alanine would be this one, and L-valine would be this one. Now, how did I do? Passed. Yay. And remember, there's leucine, which is just to add one more carbon. We have learned 4 of the 20 what are called essential amino acids, which we'll get into that classification later. But if we can do 4 today, and we do 4 another time, 4 another time, by the time of the test, we'll have all 20 of them. So I strongly recommend, and we all know what that means when I strongly recommend something, that you commit these 4 amino acids to memory. And then we'll get the rest later. Let's say that I want to make the tripeptide VGA. Yeah, since we're in a graphical mode here. So if I want to make valine, glycine, alanine. Alanine is going to be the carboxylic acid end that I don't want to have react. Correct?
So here's what I'll do. I'll take alanine. And is it all right if I leave lone pairs out here like I did on sugars? Nobody's going to miss the lone pairs terribly. I have to just relay this very amusing story. We somehow got off track talking about languages one day, and one of the other students in the other classes was writing his name using the Arabic script, and it had two dots on under one of the letters. So I said, oh, you have lone pairs in your name. Isn't that great? So, alanine, I'm going to react with sodium hydroxide. Okay, I'm going to show lone pairs here just so we know that that oxygen is negative. If I then take the resin a carboxylic acid salt is only a weak base, but it's a base, which means technically it could be a nucleophile. The benzyl halide is a particularly reactive substrate. So even if normally maybe you didn't have the best base to use right here, this will still work. Now, what happens? Well, nothing. Not until you somehow force that hydrolysis of the ester. As long as you avoid that, then every reaction you do with this now functionalized B has a one-step cleanup to it. You dump the beads out of solution, you wash them with some water or something, and dump them right back into your next reaction flask. So this platform-assisted synthesis works in the following way. You start out with the bead. You put your first amino acid on it by deprotonating it and protonating it and just doing a SN2 reaction. You can then dip the bead into your next solution, pull it out, dip it into the next one, pull it out, dip it into the next one, the next one, the next one. And this is an automated synthesis that works at least 20 or so times for making small amino acid chains. If we were to do this without using this support, it's called, then as we add one more amino acid and keep on adding and adding them, we're making huge molecules that start to be difficult to work with in solution. A big enough peptide chain won't easily dissolve. But if we put it on this bead that isn't going to dissolve anyway, at least we have a way then to separate out these compounds from solution and purify them, and they continue to the next step without having to distill or do chromatography or anything else on it. So it was a huge deal, and I believe that this is what Merrifield got his Nobel Prize for, as it was in the earlier days of amino acid chemistry. So to show you what happens next, we want to put the next amino acid onto this amino terminus that's available. That means whatever amino acid next that we need to use has to have N protection to it, so that only its carboxylic acid reacts. Well, our next amino acid, if we're trying to make VGA, is to have glycine. So I'll take glycine. React it with the other name for the T-Boc reagent is Boc anhydride. So we have the protected glycine that has that reactive carboxylic acid group. For shorthand, if I call the support resin that's got the first amino acid A, and if I call the protected amino acid that we just made B, A plus B plus DCC equals a dipeptide. And again, at this point, you literally just filter out the beads, the reagents go away, you dip this in trifluoroacetic acid. It turns out that as long as you control the conditions carefully, the polymer support will not react with this. Turns out that that Bach group ends up being more reactive. That means you can deprotect this amino group and it's now ready to react with the next amino acid. So we could take valine and let's jump ahead. Let's say already we've made the protected valine. React those with DCC. Now we have a tripeptide. Trifluoroacetic acid again. Will deprotect the amino group. And then I still don't yet know this mechanism. I'm going to have, I'm determined to find it this time. For whatever reason, HF reacts with benzyl ethers. Because if you look at that protecting group, yes, we have an ester from the perspective of what you see here. But if you look back up at what we have, we've got this benzyl group connected through an oxygen to that position. So from that benzyl group's perspective, it's a benzyl ether. It reacts with HF to give us the released, deprotected tripeptide. That is the Merrifield-Revenson synthesis. So summarize it one more time. You protect the last amino acid in the chain by putting it onto the resin first. That way that the carboxylic acid end you protect once and never have to keep on protect. The first method I showed you, you would have to keep protecting it that way. So once you have that amino acid attached, you then protect your second amino acid, or the second to last amino acid, I should say, join it together, deprotect. Take the next amino acid, join it together, deprotect. You keep assembling until you've got all your amino acids that you want. You do your final deprotect, and then you release it from the platform, and you've got your peptide chain. So, for Tuesday, the pre-lab you should do is for the first in the four-lab sequence, that is the formation of a dipeptide. I forget the names of each of the four experiments, but that's what those four are. They're in sequence, in order. And we're going to begin the first one on Tuesday. Now, as far as the rest of the day, you'll have the time to make your luminol glow. I need to go change, and I'll go grab the text that has the procedure in it. Again, there's no melting point that you have to do, so ignore that part of the procedure. And there's no IR you need to do. Simply to make it glow is good enough characterization.